possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Oxford historian and political writer Timothy Garton Ash joins us today. His latest book, Free World, examines the future of the relationship between Europe and America. The entire title, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. Garton Ash says Washington cannot rule alone, and he says Europe can realize its aspirations only in transatlantic community with the U.S. Timothy Garton Ash is the author of 8 books, including The History of the Present. He is director of the European Studies Center at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His essays appear regularly in the New York Review of Books. He also writes a column for The Guardian. The column is syndicated across Europe and the Americas. Timothy Garton Ash's new book, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West, is published by Random House. And you can find Mr. Garton Ash on the web at freeworldweb.net. Mr. Garton Ash, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be with you from Boston.
Post-Cold War here, we have a major split between old friends, Europe and the U.S., and of course we've had disagreements before. Is this different? Is it more serious?
This one is different because throughout the Cold War, we were held together by a single clear common enemy in the center of Europe, the Red Army in Berlin, in Germany. And that was not just the glue that held us together, it was the cement that held us together. And now we have to work out what the new common enemies are, whether we see them in the same way. And as we've seen in the last few years, you know, up to now, Europeans and Americans haven't seen the new threats in the same way.
What do you think, what are the major threats, and how do we see them differently here in the States, and how are they seen in Europe?
Well, I think since 9/11, many Americans, and certainly the administration in Washington, has felt us to be at war. And they compare this war to the world wars of the 20th century. Most Europeans don't feel that way, despite the bombing of Madrid. But actually, I think if you step back and you look at the world we're in, quite coolly, and what the threats are, then you find that actually we have overwhelming common interests, whether it's, you know, the democratization of the wider Middle East, which is just next door to Europe, where our immigrants come from, whether it's the rise of China, which is a huge challenge to all of us, whether it's global warming, which is a reality that we partly create, or whether it's the huge and shaming gulf between us in the rich north and the 3 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. You know, take any of those issues, as it were, the deeper causes of terrorism, and our interests are actually identical.
Yeah, our strategic interests are very, when you set them out like that, they are the same.
Absolutely so. We just don't see it.
Yeah. America, the world's sole superpower now, and Europeans are moving toward a new union. Do Europeans hope to build, by way of the EU, a superpower to serve as a counterbalance to the U.S.?
Some Europeans do. One of the great arguments of my book, Free World, is that America is deeply divided, as we've been. The great divide does not go between America and Europe. America itself, as we've just seen in the recent election, is deeply divided on quite fundamental questions, including foreign policy. Europe is divided in a great argument between what I call the Euro-Atlanticists, people like Tony Blair, who want a strong united Europe but as a partner to the United States, and what I call the Euro-Goalists, led by Jacques Chirac, who do indeed want Europe as a rival superpower to the United States. And I think that the United States, I think all Americans, have a huge interest in seeing that the Atlanticists, the Blairites, if you will, win that argument.
Yeah. I want to share an excerpt from your book with our listeners this afternoon and ask you to expand on this and comment on it. This is from the chapter Europe as Not America. Europe and America are no longer held together by a single clear common enemy. The United States is now both absolutely and relatively more powerful and needs Europe less than it did when the old continent was the central theater of its confrontation with the Soviet Union. But the shift is even more profound and unsettling for Europe. For the United States, it poses the question, what should our role now be in the world? It does not compel Americans to ask, what is America, let alone where is America, or why do we have America at all? Yet it forces Europeans to ask precisely those fundamental questions. What is Europe? Where does Europe end? And why Europe? Meaning, what is the project of European Union ultimately for?
You know, that's exactly right. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because it seems to me that most Americans don't really get the new European story, the story of what this Europe is becoming, because it's very, very slow moving. It's very, very complex. It's very confusing. It's not a motor car being made. It's like a herbaceous border growing very slowly. But nonetheless, the story of the European Union is an amazing story. 60 years ago, the whole of Europe was at war, and there were just four free countries in Europe, perilously free, you know, Britain, Ireland, Sweden, Switzerland. Today, the whole of Europe is at peace, and there's only one unfree country in Europe, that's Belarus. Everyone else is effectively a free country. I mean, this is an extraordinary story. And the European Union is developing kinds of power which are very different from those of the United States. You know, we don't have the great armies and the amazing weapons that you have, and we never will. We have the economic power. Economically, Europe is an equal of the United States. But we also have what Joe Nye of Harvard has called soft power, the power to attract. You know, Europe, the European Union, is surrounded by countries which actually want to join the European Union, and one day may do. So far as I know, Mexico and Canada are not going to join the United States anytime soon. So one shouldn't underestimate the kind of power that this strange new European Commonwealth is creating. But it's hard to grasp. It's not like, you know, the U.S. Marines.
Hmm. What are the most significant differences, do you suppose, today between the U.S. and Europe? And then taking a look at the differences, what are the similarities? What can we build on?
Well, the similarities are just so huge. I mean, look, the United States started life as a version of the European Union. It was actually the first European Union. You know, it was built by immigrants from Europe. The values we share are just huge, and indeed the goals we share, the interests we share. So the interesting question is, why are we so divided?
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a couple of things on the American side that I point to. One is this sense of overwhelming military power and yet of vulnerability. I mean, you know, here's the military hyperpower, and yet they destroyed the Twin Towers. And that produces, I would say, a slightly, in this administration, a slightly nationalistic and even militaristic approach to solving the problems of the world. I mean, reach first for the hammer, even if the problem is not a nail. The other is very well known to you, and it's the issue of religion. You know, Europe is one of the most secular continents on Earth. America is really the only country in the world which is rich and Western, but also highly religious. And that is, I think, a great divide, although it's also something, of course, that divides red America from blue America.
Mm-hmm. Would we Americans benefit by asking those questions that are posed now to Europe? Would we benefit by asking ourselves, what is America? Where is America?
Yes, when you were reading that, I was thinking to myself that, you know, I've been in the United States for 2 weeks now, and looking at the soul searching after the election, I begin to feel that maybe Americans are asking themselves that question in rather a profound way. I have a slightly sort of English, or maybe it's also slightly American, approach to this. You know, if Germany is a country I know very well, and Germany is a country which has been asking itself, you know, what is Germany and who are we for at least two centuries. And I find that a little bit tiring. I would rather that we sat down in our slightly sort of pragmatic Anglo-Saxon way and said, well, okay, let's stop the soul-searching and just say very calmly, you know, what is this world we're in? What are the big challenges we face? How are we going to make it a safer place for our children? And then how do we go about it? And that, I think, is as it were, the conversation that we should be having. And I think many of the big differences between us are actually not so much about what you do. I mean, we all agree there are these dangers, these threats, and indeed President Bush agrees that you have to address the causes of terrorism, not just terrorism itself. Where we really fundamentally disagree is how you best go about that.
Well, a few months ago I was in Canada and I was talking with a woman, and the first thing she asked me was, are you an American? And I thought to myself, of course I said yes, but I thought to myself, she is tailoring her discussion, her conversation with me by my citizenship.
Look, I think there is a real problem here, which I think many, many Americans are aware of. You know, I had an extraordinary conversation with someone here in Boston yesterday, just a casual conversation. We were talking about the election and relations between America and Europe, and he started his reply by saying, well, I have to tell you, I'm not a great fan of my own country. And I thought that was an extraordinary thing for an American to feel he wanted to say. And the way in which, if you look at the opinion polls, I think, you know, America has never been more distrusted in the world, truly in living memory, not even at the time of Vietnam, and one has to ask oneself why that is so. I keep saying to my European friends, and the book indeed is trying to say to them, we have to keep faith with the other America. You know, Richard Pearl or Donald Rumsfeld are not America. But that's a complicated message to get across, and I fear it's often getting lost.
Yeah. Well, during the campaign, John Kerry talked about bringing Europe back to the table, and the president shot back, and I think, I don't know what kind of wounds were suffered there by Mr. Kerry, but, you know, that expresses, again, this division that we have. And, you know, the president said he would not endanger America by, you know, seeking permission to protect Americans and U.S. interests.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable statement, but no one would expect him to. We wouldn't endanger, you know, Britain's vital security by waiting to ask America, but that's obvious. Look, the whole agenda of trying to make a new beginning after this really disastrous period. You know, the biggest crisis of the West anyone can remember since 1945. It would have been much easier with a President Kerry, there's no question, but we have to start from where we are. There are some signs out of the Bush administration that they too want to make a new beginning. You know, there's a certain kind of reaching out to the European Union, but I have to tell you honestly, I wonder whether it will, how much of it will survive the first crisis, whether about Iraq or about Iran or about Israel and Palestine. And I think that crisis could come quite soon, actually.
Why do you say that?
Well, Iraq is boiling even as we speak. Mm. The Iran issue is clearly a matter of urgency. By the way, as we speak, it appears that European diplomacy has won a small triumph in relations with Iran. The Iranian regime appears to have committed itself to stop its uranium enrichment. Now, I wouldn't count on that long term, but I think it does show you that sometimes you can get further with a little soft power than you can with hard power, as seen in Iraq.
Mm. Who are Europe's pivotal players at this moment?
As ever, Britain, France, and Germany, yeah. The big three. And then what is new is that in this enlarged Europe, you know, the spectacularly enlarged Europe of 25 member states, this really extraordinary new Commonwealth, Italy, Spain, Poland, to some extent, countries like the Netherlands also play a very significant part. And as I said a moment ago, the name of the game is to try and secure a majority for what I call the Euro-Atlanticist position. And for that, you know, the swing country is actually Germany. Germany really is Europe's pivotal power, its central power. In America, seem to have taken over our old British pastime of frog bashing, you know, making jokes about the French and going on endlessly about the French. But actually, we should be talking less about France and more about Germany.
Why is Germany the pivot?
Well, it's the biggest, richest country bang in the middle of Europe. And if Germany swung back to its traditional position, which is of being as close to Washington as it is to Paris, of having a special relationship with both America and France, then the whole balance of European policy would spring back to the Atlanticist side, and then we'd be really back in business again.
Timothy Garton Ash is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a historian and political writer. His latest book, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your joining us this afternoon with a telephone call. Here are the telephone numbers. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What kind of response is the book getting from readers? I understand it's been out in Britain now for a while and now recently, more recently here in the U.S. I don't know if it's been published elsewhere in Europe, but what kind of response is the book getting from folks?
This has been fascinating, I must say. It's been an extraordinary debate already. It came out in Britain in the summer, then it came out in Germany, which, as I said, was very important, about Canada. And in the next few months, it's coming out in all the major European languages, you know, French, Spanish, Italian, Polish, and so on. I actually have a website, freeworldweb.net, where you can follow some of the debate, and you see Americans talking to Germans and Poles, arguing with Canadians and Argentinians, discussing with Australians. You know, this extraordinary kind of worldwide conversation. What strikes me about it is, I mean, there's a tremendously lively response. There's a huge affirmation of the need for Europe and America to work together to address these issues. What strikes me most about that conversation, which your listeners can visit on the web, is that the fiercest arguments of all are not across the Atlantic, not between French and Brits. They're between Americans and Americans. It's almost as if America is more divided than the West itself.
Mm. It was very interesting when I was reading the first chapter in the book, Britain and Janice. I thought, well, we also have this same kind of situation where we're trying to figure out, again, we're going back to this question of identity, who we are and what we want.
Yes, yes, I think that's right. And I think that the British choice, so many Americans are interested in Tony Blair, and Tony Blair is really his whole premiership has been dedicated to trying to bring together the two sides of Britain. You know, our ties with America and the English-speaking world, which are so strong, I mean, as you know, in all sorts of ways, in journalism, in academia, the number of British voices you hear in the American media is just extraordinary, in culture, in literature, in business, the military, intelligence. But then on the other side, our ties with Europe are just so intimate now. We're so tied into the European Union. To bring together these two sides of Britain in one coherent whole, so that, as a friend of mine put it, Britain at last knows what story it wants to tell. But, you know, for us to do that, America has to know what story it wants to tell. And it has to be a story that is about America as in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, really engaging in the world. And if we see that face of America, our job will become so much easier.
Mm. Let's talk further about this. Maybe you would talk with us about the ideas of island world and world island, because again here I found myself thinking this is also, you could say this also of the U.S., stubbornly insular and relentlessly international.
Yes, yes, that's right. Although I think it's different because, you know, we're a small island and you're a huge continent. For this book, I spent some time in Kansas and I literally drove out into the fields in the heart of Red America and asked everyone I met, when I say Europe, what do you think of? And, you know, a lot of the people I talked to just looked completely blank. They just couldn't think of anything. And then they said things like, well, there's not a whole lot of hunting down there. Or, well, it's a long ways across the pond. And I don't say this in any sort of condescending sense. I simply mean that, you know, Europe is tremendously far away, and the heartlands of America really are a world unto themselves. Yes, 4 out of 5 Americans haven't got a passport and so on. And so somehow bringing to that America the sense that the well-being of their own children in Kansas and Wisconsin and Iowa and Arizona really does depend on these things that are happening a long, long way away, on what's happening in the Middle East, on what's happening in China, on what's happening, you know, in the atmosphere above us as the Earth heats up. That, I think, is the task before us.
Mm. We have a couple of listeners ready to talk with us now. Let's go first to our first caller this afternoon in Charleston, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes, perhaps your guest could address the issue that is inherent in the capitalist paradigm, and like any other entity that man has approached, entered, gone through, and moved ahead, is fraught with imperialism. you know, the capitalism, if I understand the process right, is accruing the wealth into fewer and fewer hands, which is what is occurring in the world today. The third world and the oil-rich countries, all of these people have been robbed of their natural resources, killed and pushed aside. You know, the Brits are just famous for their colonialist policies and the subjection and annihilation of people. And how do you suppose that the system is going to get better when the nature of it is to imperialize?
I'm afraid I rarely don't agree with that analysis, which, of course, was Vladimir Lenin's analysis. He called imperialism the highest stage of capitalism. I actually don't believe that the kind of exploitation that you describe, and which, you know, I freely admit we see in lots of parts of the world, and I have a long passage in the book about the scandal that every European cow gets a subsidy of about $925 a year, and we give in aid to every person in sub-Saharan Africa just $8 a year, $925 for each European cow, $8 for an African person. I mean, that is absolutely scandalous. So there is a huge amount wrong with the system we have. But I do not believe that this is intrinsic to capitalism. I think that there are many models of democratic capitalism. There's the Swedish model, as well as the British model and the American model. And the real question before us is, can we find, as it were, a capitalism with a human face? And that's, i.e., not Enron. And that's what should be our common enterprise.
Yes, and that seems to be the answer every time, that it should be. But the reality on the ground is that Africans are the most crushed by the capitalist paradigm. And in the very countries that use it and abuse it and such, in your own words, are... how is it, now my words, is a family in the U.S., which is hugely bloated and cost of living so high, going to make a living on $6 an hour? It is patently impossible. You can't pay your rent on $6 an hour. Yeah. I mean, the thing is so skewed and upside down that it's apparent to me that Mr. Lenin, in his book, The Highest Stage of imperialism, is when fewer, and even Marx pointed at the same thing, that if the money accrues into fewer and fewer hands, as does the power, you know, which now lately the capitalists have replaced and now are trying to put up the image of royalty, and somehow that everybody else was supposed to live off the crumbs from their table. And that...
Yes, well, this is a discussion that could take many hours, but very briefly, I would point out to you that where millions of very, very poor people have been lifted out of poverty, that has been because economies like India have actually plugged into globalization, into the global market. And, you know, when Americans now are complaining about outsourcing actually means that tens of thousands, and indeed, as I say, millions of poor Indians are being lifted out of poverty by the global interchange of global capitalism. So I think the story is a complicated one, but I think that the best way forward, as I say, is to find the right version of democratic capitalism and not to look back to a system of a state socialism or another kind of planned economy, which has clearly failed.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
My comments would be, and questions would be, closely related to the first caller's. And actually what Elizabeth them are was an interview I heard with a fellow called John Perkins, who was interviewed on a show we have here in the States called Democracy Now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of it, but you were talking. I mean, as to our imperialistic actions, this John Perkins was explaining how he was part of a group enlisted by the CIA and the NSA to work for corporations like Bechtel and Halliburton, mm-hmm. and their entire what they were trying to achieve was to I'll quote a little bit of this. It was giving loans to countries, huge loans that they couldn't possibly repay. One of the conditions of the loan, let's say $1 billion to a country like Indonesia or Ecuador, would be that 90% of that loan would have to go back to a U.S. company, something like Halliburton and Bechtel. And those companies would then go in and build electrical systems or ports or highways that would basically serve just a few of the very wealthiest families in those countries. And the poor people would be stuck in those countries, ultimately trying to repay this debt. And then that would give us the leverage to go in to, say, Ecuador and get its oil. And if you recall, what really initiated this war on terrorism was the collapse of one of our most ostentatious economic symbols, the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. And in that case, back at the oil shock in the 1970s that OPEC created, we went to Saudi Arabia, and according to this John Perkins, who apparently was kind of intimately involved in all this, we worked out a deal with the Royal House of Saud that they would send most of their petrodollars back to the United States and invest them in the United States, and that we would hire U.S. with the interest, we would hire U.S. companies to build Saudi Arabia new cities, new infrastructure, and as long as the House of Saud agreed to maintain the price of oil within acceptable limits to us, which they've done all these years,
yes.
We would agree to keep them in power as long as they did this.
Yes. No, I agree with you. I mean, I think there is a huge problem there, that the money which supposedly goes to the third world, it comes straight back via the Marriott Hotel to lobbyists and special interests here. But you mentioned a very important thing at the just at the end there, which is the way in which we in the West for the last 50 years have treated countries like Saudi Arabia, and in fact the whole Middle East, is, you know, one big dumb gas station, really. Indeed, with our tacit assent, Saudi Arabia has been a breeding ground for the Wahhabi indoctrination of young people. And of course, out of that Wahhabi indoctrination, some of the terrorism has come. So that I think that one of the things we have to do together, and one of the ways Europe can, if you like, respond even to the second Bush administration, is to say, we agree with you that what we need now is a completely different approach to the wider Middle East, one very different from that taken by the senior Bush administration, which was, of course, very close to the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. We agree that we need a strategy for spreading freedom in the wider Middle East, but, you know, it's not a good way to start by invading a country. And here's how we think it should be done.
I think you're kind of sidestepping the real problem here, but let me just say that in this country has a little bit of familiarity with our kind of rapacious attitude toward other countries and what we do in international finance to get other countries to almost into indentured slavery kind of situation, in that the farmers here were many of them were made to go bankrupt when we lent them loans that they couldn't repay. So I think one of the best quotes I've heard that you've given was that the essence of democratic politics is about working in half truth, and I appreciated
exactly.
that.
So. Exactly so, and
thank
I mean
you.
I think our job, you know, yours and mine, is what Václav Havel, the great Czech dissident, called living in truth. In other words, my job is to speak truth to power, to tell it as it is, and that's what, you know, I think we should all be trying to do. And talking to each other and finding those truths, because we're certainly not going to get them from those at the top.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana. Line 2, hi.
Hello. I was the one who broke in earlier. I wonder if the Europeans, when the Europeans will realize that they're not likely to get a President Kerry or any president who has a greater interest in the visible world as long as the media here is totally dominated, almost totally dominated, by the right wing, and Republican governors and secretaries of state are free to rig elections as they please. Thank you. I'll hang up now.
Well, that was very clear. I don't know about the rigged elections. I really don't know. But I do agree about the problem of distorting media. I mean, I watch Fox News regularly here and talk to conservative talk. They listen to conservative talk radio, not talk to it because they won't put me on, but listen to it. And it is very interesting indeed to see how in an almost Orwellian way, a kind of distorted reality is created. We actually have that problem to some extent in Britain too, as I describe in the book, with the press owned by Rupert Murdoch, which kind of suggests that the whole European Union is a great French plot to invade Britain and rob us of our liberties. Nonetheless, we do still live in what are essentially, in spite of everything, free countries. And there are programs like this on which we're talking. You know, there are the newspapers, and it's for us to find those outlets where we can still tell it as it is.
Oxford historian and political writer Timothy Garton Ash, our guest today here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West, is published by Random House. And you can find out more about the book, and you can join in discussions and read some of Mr. Garton Ash's columns on the website freeworldweb.net. We have a few more minutes in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question or a comment, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. I want to thank you for your essays in the New York Review of Books. That's how I keep track of you. Normally, I'm way early in the program, but I didn't know if the question I wanted to ask made much sense. But after listening to the people asking you questions and your answers, I'll go ahead. On a program that was over the same radio station, she's from, a person said that the real goal of the Bush administration was to show the world that, synopsis-wise, we'll fight for oil, and to give a warning to China that we will take care of the oil, and in that sense, sort of balance the competition against them in terms of they seem to be the next big boy on the block. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
Yes. Well, I think there's a more interesting balancing act, isn't there, which is that China and Japan bankroll the huge U.S. deficit. And in return, we continue and you continue to take their goods. I mean, it's good for their exports. Listen, I think the whole context in which we're talking is this. We're so used to thinking that the West, Europe and America, are going to be the richest and most powerful part of the world because, you know, we have been for the last 500 years. But we weren't always. And one day we won't be again, and that day may come sooner than we think. If you look at the fantastic economic dynamism of China and India, and what we really have to ask ourselves is, how are we going to use the last 10 or 20 or 30 years when we do have most of the power and most of the money? And what is history then going to say about how we've used that power and how we've used that money? So that's, I think, you know, so to speak, our responsibility before history, and that's what I want really to provoke a debate about with my book, which argues that we do actually have a great opportunity to move from the old, what we used to call the free world, which is just the anti-communist West, towards a free world.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. Was Vaclav Havel dwelling in the truth when he said to the American Congress that the Cold War was a conflict between two superpowers, one a nightmare, the other the defender of freedom?
No. I think that if you were looking at the world from Central Europe, if you're looking at the world from Prague, actually, yes, the United States did a magnificent job on the whole in supporting freedom, with some hesitations and some deformations, but nonetheless, I traveled there a lot in the 70s and 80s, and really it was Americans, not just the government, but even more independent Americans, who were supporting the oppositions consistently. If you look at the world from Nicaragua or El Salvador, where I've also spent some time, it's a rather different story. So I think, in a way, that's an illustration of the old adage that where you stand depends on where you sit.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and I'm going to jump in here because we just have like about a minute and a half left. And I want to sum up here, and I want to, you mentioned that, you know, you see this book says there is a window of opportunity. We have a window of opportunity for the spread of freedom and the reduction of poverty in the world. And you mentioned 10, 20, 30 years. What kind of progress can we make in that period of time? And what can individuals do?
A very good question. The spread of freedom has actually been spectacular. You know, in 1974, there were just 39 democracies in the world. Now there are about 116. 88 free countries classified as free. And there are a number of very, very simple things that we can do that would make a huge difference. We've got only a little time, so let me tell you just two. One is lower our tariffs, cut our agricultural subsidies, let in more goods from the developing world. Much more important even than aid is trade. Secondly, I argue in the book that every one of us who has a decent income in a rich country can well afford to spend 1% of our annual income on good charities which are dedicated to helping the poorest of the poor in the third world. And that's certainly what I intend to do out of this book, and I think it's something that any of us can well afford to do if we believe in the larger goal of a free world.
Hmm. There we will leave it. We're out of time. Timothy Garton Ash, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a great pleasure.
Timothy Garton Ash is a historian at Oxford. He's a political writer. His essays appear regularly in the New York Review of Books. He also writes a column for The Guardian, and that column is syndicated across Europe and the Americas. You can read that column as well as an ongoing conversation between Mr. Garton Ash and the readers of his latest book, Free World, on the website freeworldweb.net. His book, Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West, is published by Random House. And that was an interview from November 15th of 2004. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today for The Afternoon Magazine. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, this morning USDA's export inspection figures considered to be fairly neutral for the trade, but the trade looking at the last couple of sessions and deciding they should push on upward in both the wheat and the corn pits and upward in the bean pit, that on the export inspections being, not so terribly bad, but certainly some dry conditions developing in South America. We'll talk about those later during the closing mark report at about 2:32 this afternoon when we take a closer look at the agricultural weather across that area of the world. Now let's begin in the wheat pit for the day. The March contract on this February the 14th, Valentine's Day, a 302 and a quarter high, the low at $2.94.5, settled above that magical $3 level at 301 and three quarters, and they were up 7 1/4 in the wheat pit today. May futures at 309 and a half high, low at 302.5, a settlement price at 309 and a quarter, up 6 1/4, and the July contract at 308 and three quarters high, or rather 317 high, a low at 308 and three quarters, a settlement price at 316 and a half, up 7 1/2. And September futures, 322 and a half, the high, the low at 314 and a half, settlement price there at $3.22.5. They were up 8 cents for the day. And December contract at 332 high, low at 323 and a half, a settlement price at 330 and three quarters, and they were up 8 cents. The wheat pit in Chicago following to some extent what was happening in Kansas City today. March corn now at the Board of Trade, 201 and three quarters, the high, the low at $1.98 and a half, stayed above the $2 level at $2.50, up 2 1/4. May futures, 210 and a half high, low at 206 and a quarter, settlement price at 208 and a half, and they were up 2 1/2. In July, 215 and three quarters the high, the low at 212 and three quarters, settlement price at 215 and a quarter, up 2 3/4. September futures, 222 and a half the high, the low at 220 and a quarter, settlement price at 222 and a quarter. They were up 1 3/4 for the day. In December futures, 232 the high, low at 230, a settlement price at 231 and a half in the corn pit, up 1 1/4. That's the final price for the day of your new crop December corn. March corn for 2006, 239 and a quarter the high, the low at 237 and a quarter, finished up closer to the high at 238 and three quarters, up 1 1/4 for the day. March oats for the day now, 164 and a quarter high, low at $1.61 and a quarter, settled $1.61 and a half. They were a penny lower, and the May oats were off 0.5 cent. A 159 high, low at 57 even, and a settlement price at $1.57 and a half for the May oats, and they finished 1/2 lower. From the soy complex, nearby March soybeans, 10 cents higher on the end of this Monday afternoon, a 535 and three quarters settlement price, with the high at 537 and the low at 526, going above 525, and that should be important for gains continuing throughout this week. We'll ask Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing about that this afternoon during the closing market report. May futures, 537, the high, the low at 526 and a half, a settlement price at 536 and a quarter, up 9 3/4. And July soybeans, 539, the high, the low at 528 and a half, settled there at $5.38 and a quarter cents. They were up 10 and a half. August futures, 540 and a half, the high, the low at 532, a settlement price at 540 and a quarter, up 9 3/4. And September futures in the bean pit, 542, the high, the low at 534, settlement price at 539 and a half, up 8 cents. In November soybeans, 549, the high, the low at 540 and a half, settlement price at 547 and a half. They were up 8 1/2. January contract on the day, a 553 and a half high, low at 550, or rather at 547, and a settlement price at $5.53 in the January 2006 soybeans, and they were up 8 1/4 for the day. March bean meal from the products now, 161.40, the high, the low at 157.40. Settlement price at 161.20, up 4.10, and the March, May bean meal at 160.90 high, the low at 157, and a settlement price at 160.70, and they were up $4.60 for the day. March bean oil, 20.40, the high, the low at 19.77. Bean oil settled at the Board of Trade today, 19.97. They were off 4 cents. And the May bean oil contract, 20.50, the high, the low at 19.93. A settlement price at $20.17, and they were down 2 cents this afternoon. Hey, we'll have something from the Mercantile Exchange or related to the Mercantile Exchange during the closing market report today, and to ABC Television. If you happen to watch Boston Legal, which is a fictional drama that airs on Sunday nights, last night the episode title was Till We Meet, M-E-A-T, Again, all about BSE and mad cow disease and the human form of that, VCJD. We'll have complete details during the closing market report. You might want to join us at 6 after the next hour. Now with us to take a look at the Mercantile Exchange numbers is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. Feeder cattle finished lower today while live cattle and hogs were higher. March feeder cattle, $100.35, the high, $99.55, the low. The settlement, $100.12.5, that down 2.5. April, $99.40, the high, $98.70, the low, $99.35, the settlement, that unchanged. May, $98.07.5, the high, $97.45, the low, the settlement, $98.00, that down 2.5. February live cattle, $90.47.5, the high, $89.92.5, the low, finishing at $90.40, up 30. April, today's high, $87.20, the low, $86.55, the settlement, $86.95, that up 12.5. February lean hog, $67.85, the high, $67.65, the low, the settlement, $67.77.5, that up 7.5. April lean hog, $73.15, the high, $72.45, the low, $72.57.5, the settlement, that up a nickel. May, $73.97.5, the high, $73.20, the low, the settlement, $73.97.5, that up 27.5. June lean hog, $77.22.5, the high, the low, $76.35, the settlement, $77.07.5, up 45. And February bellies, $87.70, the high, $87.25, the low, $87.65, the settlement, that up a nickel. The Dow is off 15 points at 10,781. The NASDAQ down 1 point at 2076. The S&P 500 down 1 at 1204.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Matthew Litwin from San Francisco, California, wants to know, dear Dr. Science, after the great advances in particle board over the last 50 years, is there work being done to research subatomic particle board?
It's good to know that someone else out there is as excited as I am about particle board. It's heavy, it's brittle, the edges are so sharp they cut like a knife, yet it absorbs water like a sponge and literally melts in a damp basement. Leave it to nuclear, or as Jimmy Carter called it, a nuclear physicist, to use our tax dollars to find a way to reproduce this material at the atomic level. I mean, it's like dollhouse furniture. Miniatures that are so exact in their detail, a startling testament to a commitment to make things smaller.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.